The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from Val Ackerman, Commissioner of the Big East Conference.
The Big East Conference includes many sports, but the Big East is best known for its men's and women's basketball. Tough, gritty, hard-nosed, physical basketball. Over the past 35 years, the Big East has produced some of the most legendary college basketball teams, coaches, and players that have ever played the game. Coaches such as Gino Auriemma, Raleigh Massimino, John Thompson Sr., Jim Calhoun, Jim Boeheim. Players such as Alonzo Mourning, Allen Iverson, Carmelo Anthony, Chris Mullin, and Patrick Ewing. And of course, UConn's women basketball program, which for many years was part of the Big East, has set an historic standard of excellence. The Big East is once again reigning on top of the Men's Basketball Summit with Villanova's exciting and extraordinary win on Monday night in the men's NCAA championship game over North Carolina. Warmest congratulations to the Villanova Wildcats, as well as to our speaker today, Val Ackerman, the commissioner of the Big East Conference. But Val, yes, thank you. Congratulations. But Val is much more than just the commissioner of the Big East Conference. She is the architect of the present conference, which has undergone a recent transformation. And now that Butler University is a member of the Big East, all of us living in Indiana have a greater connection with and admiration for the Big East and the work that Val has done. Val has been the commissioner of the Big East Conference since 2013, following an extraordinary career as a player, sports executive, and attorney. Val's connection to basketball is deep and longstanding. Val was an outstanding player herself. During her four-year career as a starter at the University of Virginia, Val was the school's very first person to score 1,000 points. And Val has already been a historic figure in the development of basketball. She is well known as being the very first president of the WNBA, the National Women's Basketball Association. Before that, she was an executive with the NBA. But she was the president of the WNBA from 1996 to 2005. And in 2011, Val was named to the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. Val earned a law degree from UCLA and worked in private practice in New York in banking and corporate law. But please join me in welcoming and congratulating the commissioner of the great Big East Conference, Ms. Val Ackerman.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matt, for those very, very kind words. It is an absolute pleasure to be here with all of you today, and I want to thank you and the Economic Club of Indiana for your very, very kind invitation to me to be able to come and say a few words. And I want to commend you for opening your doors the way you have, I know, for many years, and kind of opening it up to serve as a forum on, I think, what you called civil and thoughtful dialogue about topics of national import and interest. And so for me, it really is an honor to be on your illustrious list of speakers. I have to give a shout out at the very top of the program here to Butler University. Go Bulldogs. I want to especially acknowledge President Jim Danko, sitting on the right side of the room here, my boss, one of my bosses. You know, Matt, I appreciate your kind words. You know, I've worked long hours for the Big East the last couple of years, but to say I was the architect of what it is now would be a bit off. I want to give credit to President Danko and the other presidents of our conference who, before I came onto the scene, had the vision that a return to a basketball-centric conference married up with a national sports network, this time not ESPN but Fox Sports One, with the Big East name playing in big cities, having its men's basketball tournament at the end of the year, Madison Square Garden, was a good idea and an idea worth pursuing. And so I want to credit Jim, frankly, for helping set all that in motion and for all he's done to make this a great league. So, Jim, thank you very, very much from all of us at the conference office. I also want to give credit to our athletics director, Barry Collier, I think is here. Barry is absolutely one of the best in the business in intercollegiate athletics. He's got an extraordinary staff at Butler, and it really is an amazing community there. I feel very lucky over the last few years to have gotten to know these great, great people, the faculty, administrators, coaches, student athletes, and, of course, the amazing supporters of not only Butler basketball but all of Butler sports, not only here in Indianapolis but across the Midwest and all around the country. We really could not be prouder to have Butler as a member of our conference, and I can't speak glowingly enough about the role that they've played in helping establish the Big East as one of the finest, and today I'd say finest, college basketball conferences in America. So hats off to the Bulldogs again. Needless to say, I'm probably looking a little travel, tested here. I've been in Houston. I was there for a few days this past weekend, and I can tell you that the performance of another Big East member, Villanova Wildcats, was truly inspiring. They, of course, won the national title in thrilling fashion. I've got 10 children. And, Butler's at the top of the list, but I got to say, Villanova right now, they're kind of really close, Jim. So I'm, hope you don't mind. And you were at Villanova, so I think you understand, okay, how your loyalties can get torn here. So I know I'm in basketball country here, and so I thought that I would center my remarks today around really just that, the game of basketball. And it's a sport I'm very proud to say I've been associated with nearly all of my life. First, let me give you a little bit of background. I grew up in a small town in New Jersey. I am a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and I'm just saying that. I was lucky. I played sports really, of all kinds as a young girl. My dad was a high school athletics director. He was also a high school basketball referee, so I actually have a real affection for the guys in the striped shirts on the court. And he nurtured what I like to call a backyard, basement, and driveway sports environment for my brother and me. This was a steady diet of badminton and croquet and knock hockey, throwing footballs around the yard and a whole lot more. But basketball was really my favorite sport. After taking my playing career as far as I could go, I went from the hoop in the driveway to playing in high school right around the time that Title IX was passed to playing in college. Matt noted, I played at UVA, still very proud to be associated with the place. It was a time when women's scholarships were just coming into being. And my first year, actually, at UVA, there was one scholarship that was available to the entire women's basketball team. I split it with a teammate. My coach was very inventive. Why get one when you can get two for the price of one? And here's how it worked. I got tuition and fees, and my teammate got room and board. So I got to go to class, and she got to eat. So it was sort of a sharing deal. But it got better, and by the time I left in 1981, most of the team was getting some form of what was then called, and at times still called, grant in aid. We went from being 8-19 my first year to 20 wins my last two, and nationally ranked at one point, and it was really a thrill, to be on the ground floor of that program at that school at that time. I went on from there, and I had a chance to play, because there was no WNBA back then, for a women's professional team in France. Quite an adventure at a day when, kids didn't have cell phones. My parents were ashen-faced. So I said, I'm going to France, 1981. See you in a couple of months. But they were good sports about it, and it was a great experience for me. After going through all these, sort of player steps, I went on to law school, as Matt noted, and did some work on Wall Street. And then I was fortunate enough to land a job at the NBA, or I call it sometimes the MNBA, okay? Back in... David Stern used to always like that. I think he liked it. Maybe he didn't like it. But I started there in 1988 and really have been part of this great sport ever since. I moved from the NBA to the WNBA. I did a stint as chair of USA Basketball I served as the U.S. representative for 8 years for the International Basketball Federation as a board member. And now it's on to the NCAA and the Big East. And my job encompasses not only men's and women's basketball, but 20 other sports that we proudly sponsor. So I've had a great, great career. And as I said, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I think I'm a basketball person at heart. It's obviously been a monumental week for college basketball. Another reason basketball is top of mind for me. In addition to being Houston, I had a chance to watch the University of Connecticut, a former Big East member, now member of the American Athletic Conference. I had a chance to watch the what I'll call machinery at work last night here in Indy, just down the street at Bankers Life. And, you know, obviously it was an inspired season, has been many inspired seasons for the Huskies as well. And so I thought I'd use my time today to make a couple of observations about the state of the sport. I'm assuming we've got basketball fans in the audience. I hope so. I'm taking my chances here. And I want to talk a little bit about some observations, again, that I have being around the business for many years and the impact and maybe the opportunities for the sport, not only here in the U.S. and around the globe. Since I know that this is also David Letterman country, I'm going to present this in sort of top 10, you know, list fashion. So here we go. But unlike what Dave would do, these thoughts I have are not in any particular order. So let me start with number one. Number one, I've been to a lot of basketball games in my life, and I would put March Madness at the top of the list as the most exciting event in the sport. You know, I've been to many amazing NBA playoff games, WNBA playoff games, All-Star games. I've been to every Olympic basketball competition since 1992. The medal rounds there are amazing, particularly when you bring the patriotism element into play. And you see some of these smaller countries who, you know, for whom these teams mean everything. You know, countries like Spain and Greece and Serbia, I mean, they're national teams. These folks are just heroes in these home countries. But if you ask me, March Madness is just unique and in a league absolutely of its own. The way it brings people together from all around the country, it pits the big and small schools against each other, and then it never seems to disappoint with these unscripted moments, this high drama and these heroics. It just makes it one of a kind in my mind. Tom Jernstedt, former NCAA EVP and a very good friend of mine, is known as the father of the Final Four. He's in the audience today. And Tom, I just want to thank you again for everything you've done to make that event a reality. You really came up with something very, very special. Thank you, Tom. So number two, I'm sometimes asked about the so-called problem of one and done in men's basketball. And what I would sort of share, it's a long sort of speech about sort of what, you know, the history of that and all the implications of it. But I would just say to you, in my opinion, it's a bit overblown. For those of you, you know, who don't know, this is a reference to the NBA's eligibility rule that allows a men's basketball player 1 year out of high school to be eligible for the NBA draft. The rule has, in fact, led to players leaving college early for the pros. But while this is so often publicized and a lot is made out of it, the number is actually very small. On average, less than 1% of all freshman players annually, or roughly 8 per year, actually get drafted. So it's not a lot of young men who are sort of one and done, you know, players at the end of the day. The real destabilizing force in college basketball, and this is something Barry Collier knows, is actually transfers. I mean, that's what impacts college rosters significantly, and the NCAA is, in fact, closely studying that particular topic. The reality is that upperclassmen, juniors and seniors, and in some cases graduate students, are still a big part of the student-athlete base for many teams, and their impact is truly substantial. Villanova, just a few nights ago, was led in its title run by two seniors and two juniors. UNC's star player was a senior, and two other seniors played a key role. Butler this year, of course, was led by two very accomplished seniors, Rosie Jones and Kellen Dunham, as was Providence, another proud member of the Big East Conference led by Chris Dunn, who elected to go back to school for his senior year and get his degree, and he will be a first-round pick in the NBA draft this year. I'll actually brag a little bit when I say that Big East schools cumulatively have among the best and highest graduation rates for men's basketball around the country. So I could throw a few more facts and figures at you, but my point only is that this problem of players coming to college for a, you know, what someone would call a proverbial cup of coffee, and then jumping off to the pros is, in my judgment, less widespread and less of a problem than it actually appears. And I think it's a shame that it's come to define the sport in the minds of some. And in fact, this year especially, I think you're seeing again the renewed attractiveness of programs with students who want to stay in school and who understand it at the end of the day. That's really what matters, getting your degree. So that's number two. Number three, I believe that the value and the importance of the collegiate basketball experience has become undervalued in today's pay-for-play debate. When young men and young women go to a school like Butler or Villanova to play basketball, the reality is they're getting so much out of the package. It includes not only that athletic experience, particularly in men's basketball playing for a great league like the Big East, but it's about academics, and there are so many other benefits that go along with both the academics and the athletics. Some of that value can be measured with a price tag when you start to add up tuition and fees and room and board and this cost of attendance supplement that's now allowable, the value of medical services, academic advising, apparel, meals on top of the meals. It's all tax-free, by the way. But some of this value just can't be measured. Think about the advantage in today's world of graduating from college debt-free, getting life skills, teamwork, and leadership training in this very unique way. You know, no activity teaches all of that like sports, in my opinion. These young people travel around the country. In some cases, they get to see the world because of their sort of basketball adventure. They enter a network. They enter a family that you're part of for life. And if you want to understand the value of family, talk to the people at Butler University. That's about as tight-knit a basketball family as I've ever seen. And for some, it's about getting into a school that you may have been completely not able to get into. It may have been completely out of your reach were it not for the opportunity to play on a team. And then for women's athletes, and I know this well, I live this, the intercollegiate athletic experience has been shown, there's actually data showing that there is a very strong correlation between playing on a team at the high school or intercollegiate level and then having future success in a variety of professional fields. Many C-suite women today will tell you, more than half, they had a college sports experience as part of their resume. Yes, there are revenues generated in big-time college sports programs. Of course, look at all the interest, so all that leads to revenue, but I can tell you that from where I sit, a great deal of value does go back to the students, and I just hope that the current parade of litigations facing the NCAA and some of these negative perceptions surrounding these commercial outcomes don't obscure the real good that college sports brings to now 470,000 student athletes across all three NCAA divisions each and every year. That's a lot of good, and that story is not often told. So that's number three. Number four on my list, my Letterman list, the development of young players is so important for the future of all sports, and basketball is absolutely no exception. What happens with kids who play in grammar school and high school and in leagues outside of the scholastic system, the so-called travel teams, what happens in all of those places has a profound impact, not only on what kinds of players these young people will become, but what kind of people they turn out to be. And so what I would say is all of you who are supporting, these young kids playing the sport, either as volunteers, as sponsors, maybe simply as fans. My mother still goes to my high school basketball team. She's not, I've been gone for 40 years from my high school. My mother still goes and watches my high school team play. It's adorable, but she loves it. She's the biggest fan. I was with her the other day. She showed me a picture of her with the team. I mean, that really counts for something, and they appreciated it. They appreciate the support. And especially, so you're doing a great service, is what I would say to you. And especially those of you who are actually doing the value transmitting, as teachers or coaches, thank you. Because it really is so important. I make the point about this pipeline also because actually in women's basketball, it's become a little bit topical because young girls today have a lot more organized sports to choose from when they're growing up, many more than when I was a young girl growing up in New Jersey. And some in the women's game actually fear a migration over time to sports like volleyball or soccer or lacrosse. You know, these sports didn't exist. And now, you know, these young girls can choose. And they're not all playing basketball, so there's sort of competition now for these great players. So it's just very interesting. It's good in many ways for women's sports, but some of the women's basketball people are, you know, are watching with interest and some concern. I can tell you that the state of youth basketball remains a very hot topic in NCAA basketball circles. And while I don't profess to have the roadmap on where this segment of the game is headed, I can assure you it matters to a lot of people. And I do hope that more can be done to ensure that this experience that young kids at all levels have, at all levels, you know, have of the game have, remains very constructive and positive and ultimately fun, right? At the end of the day, it's got to be about fun. Let me switch over and talk about women's basketball for a few minutes. This is now on number 5, if you're keeping track at home. Keying in on what happened last night over here at Bankers Life, I can tell you UConn is really good for a reason, actually for a lot of reasons. And let me just expound on this for a second. They have a great coach. Gino Auriemma is really best ever quality coach. I've sat in on his practices. He's been at it for a long time. He's going to be our Olympic coach this summer, the U.S. team. And he knows what he's doing. He is just absolutely outstanding as a teacher, as a motivator, and I would add as an ambassador of the game. At this point, they have a success breeds success continuity when it comes to recruiting. You know, the best players in the country just want to go there. So they keep getting them. And interestingly, because I mentioned early entry earlier, I will just sort of tell you as a note, there is no early entry in women's basketball, unlike there is in the NBA. And that, I think, has helped keep UConn at the top. The WNBA does not allow players to leave college after a year or two or three to jump to the pros. There is actually a minimum age requirement that's part of the collective bargaining between the league and the union. I was part of the first two collective bargaining agreements. We came up with this rule in 1999. It has stayed the rule ever since. And it essentially correlates with 4 years in college, minimum age of 22. So basically, a women's basketball player sort of has to stay in school, and the union that represents them has agreed to that. Frankly, the money isn't the same, so it isn't sort of challenged or you know, sort of taken up with the vigor that you've seen on the men's side. But that has, I think, helped a team like UConn stay on top. So when a high school star like a Breanna Stewart comes into a school like UConn, the advantage that a school acquires competitively is essentially locked in for 4 years, barring injury or transfer. So I would just say in a word, the Huskies have done a world of good for the women's game, and in my opinion, it's really now up to the rest of women's college basketball to get them some better competition and make the outcome at the tournament level much more appealingly unpredictable, that's one way to put it, like it is on the men's side. That's kind of where that sport needs to go. Number 6, I have to say, I'm very proud that this is the 20th season of the WNBA. I was there at the beginning. I actually was the architect there. I'll take some credit on that one. And this kind of longevity was really something we could only dream about back in 1996 and 1997 when this was being set in motion. This is a league with great players. Quality of play has gotten only better over time. It's providing compelling entertainment. I believe it's has been and will continue to make an important social impact in franchise cities, and it has a clear niche in the sports landscape. I often have to remind people the NBA took decades to become the behemoth that it is today. In the early years of the WNBA, we were averaging close to 10,000 fans a game. I sort of went to the NBA archivists and learned it took the NBA almost 30 years to get those attendance levels, and we were doing that out of the box. And so it takes a long time. It's a marathon, not a sprint, when you're trying to build an audience and build a league and a following. And I'm very confident that the WNBA will follow a similar trajectory over time. I do want to acknowledge the many successes of the Indiana Fever. Kelly Krauskopf, the team president, is a very good friend of mine. I'm so happy about all the great things she's done. She's done, has had extraordinary leadership in making that team a model women's sports franchise. Julie, congratulations for all your efforts there and good luck. And I really do hope all of you will give them your support this season and beyond. It's a great, great league. Number 7, the Olympics are coming this summer. Amidst all the other sports stuff going on. In my opinion, the USA Women's Olympic basketball team is the most underrated team in sports. Please pay attention to them. This team started a gold medal run at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, and it has been uninterrupted through Sydney, Athens, Beijing, and London. In Rio, they will be going for their sixth straight Olympic gold medal. This is unprecedented in women's team sports. As I mentioned, the team will be coached by who else? Gino Auriemma, features the biggest names in the WNBA, adding to the luster. And I really do hope that the media and the public will come to see that while women's soccer has done a phenomenal job, it's not the only women's team sport we're supporting at the national team level. And I hope that this phenomenal program does get its due. So I've got three observations left, if you're keeping track, numbers 8, 9, and 10. And I'm going to put all of these in the category of how sports and society intersect. Part of the excitement, at least for me, of working in basketball over the last, 27 years, has been getting to see how interconnected the game is to key issues and trends around the world. I had the privilege of working for 16 years for David Stern, now the retired commissioner of the NBA. I think he's calling himself Commissioner Emeritus, which is fine. He deserves it. I can tell you he was an extraordinary leader, very forceful guy, brilliant. He kind of could was one of those guys that could sort of look around the corners and see things coming that others couldn't see. And what an amazing experience it was for me to work for him and to learn from him. David, I think if you were to sort of sum up David's big three, I'm going to steal those and make them my 8, 9, 10 for purposes of this talk, and I'll tell you what they are quickly. One is globality. The world is, in fact, flattening, and I can tell you that basketball has a huge opportunity outside the U.S. It sort of got ignited with the 96 Dream Team, and the sport really hasn't looked back. Soccer is, in fact, king in many places, but 215 countries, and I know this because I was on the FIBA board for 8 years, 215 countries sponsor very, very serious basketball programs, from national teams down to youth competitions. And the opportunity to grow the game further around the world is simply enormous. And organizations like the NBA, in some cases NCAA programs, are doing that. And I think that the opportunity will continue to be, as I said, tremendous. Number 9, technology. Changes are constant. In the way that fans of the game of basketball sort of consume and watch games and access other content. You know, their interest in access is a big deal. Ask our men's basketball coaches about access and having cameras in their huddles and in their locker rooms and in their sort of pregame speeches. You know, they've had to sort of accept that's the way of the world now. That's what fans want to see. And technology has impacted the way players and coaches are trying to enhance performance. And so basketball needs to stay on top of all of that. Everything from the role of second and third screens to the evolution in the importance of statistics and analytics and data, and of course the power of social media platforms, which didn't exist not long ago. And this, I can tell you, has turned into a strong and growing specialty within the sports business, and in particular in the sport of basketball. So last but not least, my number 10, if you were to ask David Stern today what he thinks his greatest accomplishment was as commissioner, I am pretty sure that his answer would have something to do with the way the NBA became a leader in helping bring about positive social change through community programs, cause initiatives, championing diversity and inclusion. I mean, David saw the importance of women, I think before many others, hence the WNBA. And then the many forms of social philanthropy that they've conducted not only in the U.S. but all around the world. As schools like Butler know, the same opportunity to do good in college basketball and college sports exists in a profound way generally, whether that's through service activities, community partnerships, good works by coaches, and really just by leading by example in word and deed. I'll say as a side note here, it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with basketball, but even the Vatican has taken notice of the power of sports to affect positive social change. Several months ago, I was invited to be part of the planning committee for the first Vatican Conference on Faith and Sport. The subtitle is Sport at the Service of Humanity. This is going to be a two-day event in Rome in October with the Holy Father presiding. Yes, he's going to make a speech there about sports. They're going to, you know, maybe even give him a kit. You know, he's going to be kicking a soccer ball. I mean, there's some really interesting ideas that are being planned. And the purpose of this is to explore the ways that sports and sports organizations and organizations that are sort of linked to sports at all levels can bring people together, can provide joy and hope for the less fortunate, and can create a sort of values framework to inspire healthy and rewarding lives among so many people. I would just tell you, I think leadership opportunities continue to abound in this area of sort of sports and social responsibility. And hopefully at the Big East, with the help of schools like Butler, we can continue to do our part. I saw the movie Hoosiers. It was a great movie. Loved it. And so I thought, given that I'm with my friends from Indiana, I would close with this quote from the movie Hoosiers. This came from Coach Norman Dale. If you put your effort and concentration into playing to your potential to be the best that you can be, I don't care what the scoreboard says at the end of the game. In my book, we're going to be winners. So on that note, I'll close. I want to thank everybody again for having me today, and I'm more than happy to take any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Val, for those really wonderful, insightful, and inspiring comments. And so, and thank you for your willingness to take questions. So as a reminder, please use the white cards at your table to write questions for Val, or you may tweet those questions to me, and we'll get them right out. In fact, here comes one right now. Can you discuss the role of money in college sports and the priority then of universities with respect to the money available in college sports?
Well, I guess the simple answer is that college athletic programs don't operate for free. You know, they require funds to field teams, hire coaches, compete in games. It's just like any other unit in higher education, and so the money is clearly needed. The good news, as I mentioned, the interest in college sports has helped create a revenue stream, an important revenue stream at various levels. The NCAA, interestingly, its budget is fueled primarily by the revenues from the national television contract for the men's basketball tournament. That 16-day period we just came out of in March pays a lot of bills down the street here, and many of them for sports other than basketball. Because interestingly, the commercial interest in college sports is sort of limited to two sports most of all, football and men's basketball. So the money goes, for a lot of purposes, and I guess what I would say is it couldn't be more important for communities to support their college programs for some of the reasons I mentioned. I mean, these are great experiences for these student athletes. They're ways to bring these communities together in important ways. It's great life training for so many. Every school I talk to understands how much it matters to have particularly men's basketball, as part of their curriculum, so to speak. So whether it's through corporate sponsorships or whether it's through donor philanthropy efforts, your support makes these great programs go. And keep in mind, for a lot of these kids, this is their sports experience. They're going to go on and do other things with their lives. They're going to be like me. They're going to get out of school. It's going to be the end of it. And then they're either going to go to grad school. They're going to get a job. They're going to do other things. And they're going to look back their whole lives on this amazing experience they had and an experience that had made them a better person. So the support is needed. And again, I would sort of encourage everybody here to keep intercollegiate athletics at the top of your list as you're looking for good causes to support.
Thank you. Can you see a day when a amazing female coach will coach a great men's team?
Oh, I hope so. You know, it's so interesting. There are so many men coaching women's basketball, and I'm often asked about that. And my response always is, I think it's great. I mean, these are people who know what they're doing. They're respected by the athletes. The athletes tend not to care. They just want a coach who they can trust and respect. And when, you know, it's 3 seconds left in the game and you got the ball, they need to know that this person knows how to call the play. But I've always wondered, you know, why doesn't it work the other way? You know, why is it that sort of the women coaches have one career path, but the men's coaches have two? And so we've seen a little bit of it this year. Former player from the WNBA, Becky Hammon, is now working on the bench in San Antonio. She's an assistant coach for Greg Popovich. She's a real student of the game, seems to be doing a great job. Maybe it's her. Maybe it could be somebody else. But I think that's the future. There are some amazing women out there who know what they're doing, you know, could coach, in my judgment, men as easily as they could coach women. And it is sort of interesting to me that societally we haven't sort of given that a chance. I think it would be great to see more of it, and I would hope even more that a day would come where it wouldn't be a story. That's really the end game. You just don't even want that to be a story.
Thank you. We have several questions on this topic, which is, does the Big East plan to expand and include more schools? And if so, how far would it go? All the way to Gonzaga?
Okay, I got to ask my boss. I got to ask my boss if how, you know. Well, I'll say this. We like 10. I mean, the league is 10 right now. I would say it is a great group, very tight-knit. The old Big East had gotten sort of far-flung, and there was a division of interest, particularly among the basketball and football-driven agendas there. So this group of schools really did want to go back to sort of the centricity of purpose. And so that's sort of basketball on one hand and then the smaller size on the other. I will say that the 10 is actually, I don't say it's the tail wagging the dog, but it turns out to be a really good number for men's basketball scheduling, women's too, because their normal load of conference games during a season, you play your non-conference schedule and then you play your conference schedule. The normal load of conference games is 18. So if you've got a 10-team league, it's perfect because you can play every one of the 9 home and away. And that has turned out to be, I mean, our coaches, you know, I guess hate it, you know, when they're in the middle of it because it makes it so hard. But I would say for the league, it's been a great way to keep alive some great rivalries and then to sort of, you know, institute some other ones. So we like that. So right now nothing's cooking is how I would put it. But we're, you know, in the business of monitoring the landscape, keeping an eye on what's happening, you know, with other leagues. There's some very fine basketball schools outside of the Big East Conference. And so who knows? But I guess I would say, I've been saying, you got to check off a lot of boxes. You know, a lot of things would have to be the right fit here in order for a school to be able to come into the Big East Conference at this point.
Thank you. Again, several questions on this theme, which is, what are the keys for women to be able to have greater parity salary-wise and financial-wise, as well as audience in sports?
So I guess I'll take it at the pro level, maybe, because that is the challenge now for women's elite sports. You know, I'm fond of saying the Title IX battles, there's still skirmishing going on to make sure that equity is really, you know, those compliance pieces are working, and there's still important work to be done there, and I'm glad that organizations like the Women's Sports Foundation and the National Women's Law Center continue to make that an area of focus. But, I live this. I mean, the difference between what young girls and young women have now and when I was growing up in Pennington, New Jersey, is night and day. So to me, you know, that's a good story. It is the modern challenge now is the marketplace challenge. You know, how can these elite sports, you know, become what, you know, how can the WNBA become or even come, you know, come closer to what the NBA is? Can women's soccer make it at the pro level? They've got a great thing going at the national team. You know, what does that mean for their league? Women's softball is a great sport, rates really well, you know, at tournament time for the NCAA. You know, but it's out of the Olympics now, okay? Not enough countries were sponsoring it, so said the IOC. There's a pro league, but you probably don't even know it. What's it going to take to get that sport, you know, further along in terms of what you said, the business, and what that means for the players in terms of their, you know, their compensation? It is about, you know, at the end of the day, about revenue. I mean, there's no Title IX in pro sports. It's about the marketplace. And, you know, NBA salaries are what they are for a reason. It's because they've got massive television contracts. They're charging, you know, a lot of dollars to go to games. So ticket revenue for an NBA team is quite high. The sponsor interest is there. There's international revenue opportunities. And so as all those numbers have climbed, guess what also has climbed? Player salaries. You know, that's the deal. And in the WNBA, I mean, if the NBA's here, the WNBA, you can't see my hand. It's just that different. And so until that sort of revenue climb happens, the salaries are going to kind of stay here. Doesn't sound right. Doesn't sound fair. Doesn't sound equitable. You know, but that's it. I see the Holy Grail always as women's tennis. I think what they've done to advance that sport and put those players on a par in many ways with the male athletes is kind of what women's team sports, you know, needs to get to.
Thank you. Do you anticipate new sports becoming D1 scholarship sports? For example, rock climbing has grown 20% per year, is now an Olympic sport, and has collegiate clubs all over the country.
You know where Barry Collier is. I would ask my friend Barry, you know, he left. Okay, he's here. I don't know. I mean, hey, Barry. I'm the speaker, he told me. Okay, that's why I'm here. Maybe, you know, I think probably there was a day when nobody anticipated that women's lacrosse, you know, would be where it is, or other now what are sometimes called emerging sports would sort of get their due and would be funded at the scholarship level or would have the kind of financial commitments, you know, made to them in terms of facilities and, you know, and coaching support and the like. But I think it would have to kind of take a lot. And I think, you know, it may end up being a decision by, you know, by each school. I mean, for some schools, you know, I'll use ice hockey as an example. We have one school, we don't sponsor ice hockey in the Big East Conference, but we have one school that plays it very, very seriously, and that's Providence College. In fact, so seriously that last year they were the NCAA Division I national champion in ice hockey, and, you know, were sort of right in it this year, but didn't get all the way. So for them, you know, that's their football, you know, and they're putting a lot of money against it and you know, funding it and so on. And so it may be at some level it just becomes a decision by each school. But at some point, you know, back to the money thing, it's really going to be up to every school to decide how it wants to allocate, you know, what everyone, you know, knows are precious resources. And that kind of decision about interest level will certainly come into play.
Thank you. How has the college basketball game changed over the last 30 years?
The college game?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the question, how has the college game changed over the last 30 years? I mean, you know, I've been around the college game as long as I have at other levels of the game. You know, I mean, I think it's an amazing game. You know, I think what you've seen is, again, you know, UConn has made it a different story on the women's side. But what, you know, what I like is that in men's college basketball, there does seem to be an unpredictability at tournament time. A lot of great programs. March Madness, you know, the upsets that you see, I think are, you know, I hope they're here to stay. So the talent has been spreading around a bit. There were a number, I guess I will say in terms of immediate history, there were, I think, 25 some odd rules changes this past year in men's college basketball. So it was kind of a, you know, a big task for the referees to understand this. But there were a number of rule changes designed to improve the pace of play and reduce physicality. And some of that, for those of you who followed a lot of games this year, resulted in a lot of whistles being blown as referees were trying to keep a check on the, you know, the contact out in the perimeter area. Things that players were getting away with over the last several years in terms of, you know, touching and grabbing and, you know, bumping were whistled this year, all in an effort to create a freedom of movement out on the perimeter that many people agree, you know, just really, you know, created a great improvement in the game. And that in turn resulted in some increased scoring. There was also a reduction in the shot clock this year on men's college basketball. Went from 35, where it had been for many years, down to 30. Some wonder if that's the end or whether it could go down to 24. I'm not going to take an opinion on it. But that, you know, going down to 30 was thought to be a, you know, a very big deal. I'll say in women's college basketball, interestingly, they went to four quarters this year, which I thought was I was in support of this. So that now leaves men's college basketball as the only level of the game still playing two 20-minute halves. Okay, the NBA is 12-minute quarters. FIBA, which had been a two 20-minute half, you know, format, went to four 10-minute quarters in 2010. Women's college basketball now plays 4 10-and-a-quarters, and of course, high school basketball is a 4 times 8. So it's going to be interesting to me to see, you know, whether the fact that men's college basketball is still at 20 is seen as sort of a badge of honor for them, or a point of pride, or a point of distinction, or whether at some point they take a hard look at that too. And, you know, without getting into details, I think that's been a big plus for the women's game. So that's going to be a rules change or not to watch.
Thank you. And one more question, if you'll allow it.
I would bet for you anything.
Thank you. What Bruce Springsteen lyric or song best encapsulates the values, life skills, and lessons that a student obtains from participating in college athletics?
Did you really ask me this question? Oh, my God. Tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. Thank you. Thank you very much, Matt. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Val. How lucky are we that we got to hear from Val Ackerman today? Thank you,
thank you very much,
so
Val.
Much.
Thank you.
And again, today's presentation will be rebroadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 on Saturday, May 14th, and is also available for download at WFYI.org. And I hope you will return on May 3rd for a very special and unique Economic Club luncheon, where we will be joined by United States Senator Richard Lugar and Congressman Hamilton for a fireside chat, two extraordinary human beings, and we will get to hear from them. So thank you so much, and we'll see you back next month.
Join us next month at this time for a speech from former Congressman Lee Hamilton and Senator Richard Lugar. You can find more information at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.